Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest in our series of Empire Podcast Spoiler Specials. This one is dedicated to the latest film, the second film in fact, from Jordan Peele. It is, of course, Us. And joining me to discuss the film are two colleagues of such lethal cunning who've untethered themselves from the office long enough to form a human chain around the recording console. First up, we have Empire's editor-in-chief, bow your heads, for it is Terry White.
Hi.
You all right?
We are the smallest human chain in history.
I know, it wouldn't take very long to form this human chain.
Tiny daisy chain. Oh no, daisy chain is something else, isn't
no,
it?
No, that is it?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's daisy. A chain made of daisies, in fact. Also joining us in the spoiler special booth is Empire's John Nugent. How are you, John?
Hello, I'm all right. How are you?
I am good. This is good.
Good.
Welcome to the spoiler special.
Can we do the whole podcast like that?
No.
How long would it take before the listeners turn off?
About now. I think they've turned off now. They've gone. Oh God. Should we go home? Let's go home. Okay.
Anyway, before we start rabbiting on about Us, you see what you did there? It was good. Clever, very clever. Let's hear from the mad genius behind the film, Mr. Jordan Peele. He came into London just the other week, and I went along to have a good old spoilerific chat with him about the movie. He embraced the spoiler special concept wholeheartedly, although there are some things in this movie that he would like to remain open to people's interpretation. And we'll be interpreting ourselves as we get into it after you hear this interview with him. As always, this is a spoiler special. We get into the film. Third act revelations, major deaths, a whole kit and caboodle, twists, turns, everything with Jordan Peele pretty much right from the off. And I start with the big question on everybody's lips as per usual. So here we go. Me talking to Jordan Peele. Do please enjoy.
Enjoy!
I can't stop doing it. I can't stop doing it. It must have been really fun for Lupita Nyong'o to do.
Must be really fun for your wife.
I tried last night and she said, no.
That is a treat she's got in store.
Yeah. Who's Chris being tonight?
Martin Brennan.
Who the hell is that?
Who the hell is that? Can you blend the two?
Who the hell is
yes,
that?
You can.
Come out, you black and tans!
Oh, no.
Anyway, here's Jordan Peele. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on this very, very special Us spoiler special by the writer and director of Us, Jordan Peele. How are you, sir?
How are you? I'm very good.
Good. Are you at the point, now you haven't been able to say a thing about this movie for, what, 2 years?
Yeah.
Really?
I think in a meaningful way, I was engaged with this movie for a year.
Okay.
But the nugget of the doppelganger fear has been in my bones since I was young.
Okay, when did that start?
That started. So I credit the Twilight Zone mirror image, uh-huh. Which a woman is in the bus stop and sees herself.
Okay. Yep.
As maybe sparking this thing for me, but you know, I used to imagine seeing another me across the subway platform.
Oh my God!
You know, I grew up in New York. You know, whenever something is scares you to your core. And you don't necessarily know why.
Yeah.
That to me is a possible engine for a horror film.
Yeah, that's worthy of exploration down the line at some point.
Yes.
So we will get into that in due course. But I want to start. I start every spoiler special with the big question, the one that's in everybody's lips. Mm-hmm. What is it with you and rabbits?
I find them scary for some reason. And, you know, one of the themes of this movie is duality, obviously. And you know, rabbits are cute and lovable and fluffy. And yet if you really get up close and look at their eyes, they've got like, it's like Jaws. It's like they've got a doll's eyes. They turn over black and look at you. They do you. So I think they're scary. And recently I've been sort of observing this effect. Like if you put a rabbit brain in a human body, you would have Michael Myers. Like they do not have any sympathy, empathy. They would rip your head off if they could.
Yeah.
Is my feeling about them. They just not So they scare me.
The rabbit from Monty Python and Holy Grail is perhaps the most accurate cinematic depiction of a rabbit.
That's right. And there's a movie called Night of the Lipids.
Oh my God, yeah.
That was, and, oh, and you guys have all the animated.
Oh yeah, the were-rabbit.
No, I'm not even talking about the were. I'm talking about the that cartoon.
Oh,
that
Watership Down.
Watership Down.
Fuck me, yeah.
Traumatized a whole generation of
it Brits. It really did. That's a terrifying film. We can get into that one.
I wonder if this movie will do well here because of that, like, generational trauma of Watership Down. There's some really creepy-ass scenes in that.
I think so. I think people will be either running towards the cinema or running away from it in droves. Who knows? But I think they'll be running towards it. They'll embrace this.
You know, another thematic... There's several things going on with the rabbits for me.
Yeah.
One of the big ones is Easter.
Okay.
A celebration, a holiday of much a duality in itself. It's the rising of from this grave, and this movie, as you know, is sort of this dark Easter. It is a return, a rising of a Messiah.
Yes.
After a metaphorical death of sorts,
a declaration to the world.
Yes,
as well,
a declaration to the world as well.
You do something really interesting with the rabbits, and that you introduce them in effectively the film's credit sequence, and then you leave them alone for a while. And there's a little bit where Red refers to rabbit eating rabbits at some point. You think maybe it's just the ravings of a lunatic. Later on, you come back to that. And looking back at the opening sequence of the movie, there is so much that is studded in there. There's Jeremiah 11:11. Everything is pretty much there if you want to see it in the opening 5-10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that and seeding a movie in that way, then going away from it artfully enough that people have forgotten about it and then bringing it back towards the end?
You know, I'm pretty consistently throughout the movie giving you.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's stuff I've missed.
Little pieces. Yes.
Oh God.
Yes.
Yeah.
No. I'm still catching things. I didn't know that. But you know, I mean, you know, Zora's shirt has a rabbit on it.
Okay.
There is there's rabbits. I'm sure in the set design in certain scenes and that kind of thing. And there's also 11-11s many places throughout the movie.
I noticed one at the end on the ambulance in the final shot.
There's one in there. Yeah. You know, the black flag t-shirt makes an appearance in this movie that has this sort of like 1-1-1-1 on it. This is when you get a real nerd allowed to make a movie. You get a lot of the, and by the way, another connection to the Easter eggs, right? Uh-huh. It's like,
yeah, you know, precisely.
This is a movie. Yep. But you know, that being said, I think the idea of the Easter egg and the connection that we have to things, connections we put on things, has another meaning in this, in that there is a, you know, this idea that coincidence sort of marks a certain proximity to your other in this movie.
Yes, yes.
And that there is this relationship with science and also this relationship with faith and the soul that is, you know, I think, you know, both my movies sort of explores.
That is interesting because I was going to ask about the events of the movie. Are they in some way precipitated by Adelaide's arrival in Santa Cruz? Because it feels like everything, she feels that the coincidences are stacking up, and then suddenly it happens. And would it have happened? I mean, this also seems like something that the Tethered have been planning for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
But were they triggered in a way by Adelaide's arrival?
I think that it was as you say, it's a plan that's been in place for a long time, and it's a plan that was in place to ultimately coincide in one of this family's trips back to the area of her initial trauma and this doorway that we've established at the end of the movie that exists to this place that I call the underpass. Which is that labyrinth of tunnels.
Okay. Yeah.
Underneath the land. I mean, very careful because there's some things in this movie that I specifically don't want to answer to I have a mythology. Let's put it this way. I've got a mythology for this movie. I know a history of it.
Okay.
And my, you know, I was, as a filmmaker, I'm tasked with the choice. Okay. So you, if you know it all, how much do you give them?
Yeah.
You can give them very little and leave a lot up to the imagination. Mm-hmm. You can spew everything out there. Or you can do what I chose, which is to give you enough to let you know that I know what's going on and to leave enough question mark that the film is still scary and still activates your imagination and you can sort of continue to try to figure out as long as I keep you hanging.
And then people like me come along going, well, what did that mean? Right. And when that happened, what was going on there?
Yeah. And so I got to just, you know, if I back off, it's because
it's
strategically...
I have, I'll just show you here. I have a number of questions we can go to for something you run into. So.
Right on. Okay, let's do it. You're prepared.
Let's go back to Jeremiah 11:11. Mm-hmm. What was it about that specific passage, which I read today, the translation I found certainly was, therefore, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring evil upon them, which they shall not be able to escape. And though they shall cry unto me, I will not hearken unto them. So what was it about that passage in particular? Was it Jeremiah that you were drawn to, or was it the iconography in a way of 11:11, those four figures, those four ones?
It was both. I mean, this, you know, as you know, the character Red, which is Peter Nyong'o's scarier side, depending on how you look at it. you know, she is essentially leading this event, leading this... This brutal piece of choreography.
Yes.
It's a demonstration inspired by Hands Across America, which is, you know, a very real moment in the 1980s United States. And so I felt like it sort of referred to her intention. She is an important figure in this story, you know, in some ways the most important figure in the world in this story.
Yeah.
So she's had a vision. She's had a connection to what she calls God. And she's been shown a path. I think one of the breakthroughs in the writing process was realizing that the dynamic of the tethered was cult. That they have a complete faith in their Messiah that is Red, and to ultimately sort of imply that them being the dark sides of us, you know, we are in a cult as well. Just a less scary one on the surface.
Is part of the Tethered's reaction to Red the fact that she becomes their Messiah? Is it the fact that she comes to them from the outside?
Great question. I think so, yes. Yeah. They're special. You know, they crossed over into the other plane. So I think when she dances for them, you know, and they, you know, if you notice, the Tethered don't speak.
Yes.
You know, they don't have... language. She has to, Adelaide learns language as she bides her time dancing above. But when, you know, the original Adelaide, now Red, dances at 14, and I think she tells her story in a way, in a language they understand.
Yeah.
You know, Adelaide above is, you know, she's physically moving. I think below, she's finding her voice.
Where the movie develops fascinates me because I went into the film expecting an intimate thriller. What it develops into is something much larger, almost even apocalyptic. It could almost be the fourth part of John Carpenter's Apocalypse trilogy in a way. Yeah. And I love that about it. At what point in the writing process did you realize the scope of this thing was bigger than most people would expect?
Probably about a third of the way through the process of figuring out what this movie was.
Okay.
You know, I'm always looking for ways to, you know, make sure to scare, but also to empower the audience to have fun. And, you know, there's a thematic sort of ongoing, debate or dynamic between self and group in this movie. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is this something that our character Adelaide is experiencing alone? Mm-hmm. This trauma, or then we realize, oh no, it's her whole family yeah. is experiencing yeah. it. Then we realize, oh, it's her family and friends, and then we realize more and more and more. And but also, I think there is a the shift in genre from home invasion to zombie invasion, I mm-hmm. think is kind of a satisfying yeah. in that, you know, let's be honest, the zombie, the wide scale version is more fun than the home invasion. So I think there's a little bit of a relief that we're all in this together in a weird way, and that this is going to become a more heightened story.
Mm. And you talked there about that the self versus the group idea, and it really is brought to light in that first scene where they're tormented by the tethered, because you have the focus first of all on Adelaide, mm-hmm. but you also have the sounds of Gabe almost, you know, trying to crawl away for his life, and you have, you know, Sora and Jason running for theirs as well. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated by that sequence and how you had a handle on it, both as a writer and a director, keeping the tension cranked and making sure that, you know, we didn't lose focus of Adelaide as well.
Mm. You know, this was, you know, one of the many feats in this film that I was very lucky to have my editor, Nick Mansour, at my side, who it's written, you know, fairly clear in the screenplay, but still a very difficult scene to put together. And you're telling four stories simultaneously. And and then of course when you bring Michael Abels, our composer's mm-hmm. work, he has to kind of weave these motifs together as well. You know, I think the way we approached it was just on a beat to beat level, just try and keep momentum going and make the most fun decision. What did we want to see at any given point?
Yeah. I want to go back to the idea, the big idea that drives the movie, of the tethered and the untethered, and how that developed from that early fear of doppelgangers and maybe seeing yourself on the subway in New York, to the idea that there is almost a shadow world beneath us, that we're all connected somehow to this group of others.
Well, one of my sort of rules for when I'm making a film is to take an absurdity. In this case, a horror absurdity, there's mm-hmm. another me, mm-hmm. Try and ground it as much as possible. Try and have it be real. If that's true, then what? The moment I decided I knew I could write, I had a doppelganger film in me, mm-hmm. was the moment I realized I had never seen a family of doppelgangers. And that brings a sort of exponential level of processing.
Yes.
So I said, okay, let's say family of doppelgangers, everyone has a counterpart and they're here. What does that mean? And, the path that takes you down is, okay, this is the reason it's scary is because it means that at the same point you met your husband or wife, mm-hmm. the doppelganger met your wife or husband's doppelganger.
Yeah.
The same moment you fornicated and had that, you know, honeymoon sex or whatever, and your first daughter was conceived, it would have happened simultaneously, you know, yeah. by definition, because the same sperm and egg met for them to look identical.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you follow that.
Yeah.
So that led me to this idea of there's a tether. You cannot have two existing unless there is a fated connection between the two, mm-hmm. That I explore in a very poetic way. I think it's important that that fate doesn't work scientifically. It works in ways we don't necessarily always understand, but that certain moments are connected. And that led me to this idea of you can make another body, but you cannot bifurcate a soul. Soul remains one, mm-hmm. and these characters are these characters share a soul.
And you've talked in the past about how this movie, in a way, is you're addressing the idea that the tethered are the disenfranchised, and they're the people that you ignore, the people that you would step past on your way to the shops. That's just one element of it, obviously. Mm-hmm. But that comes to me, that is summed up in the film's, I think it's the film's key line, which is, we're Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, that surprised the hell out of me. I was like, what's she going to say? What could she possibly say? I am the ultimate manifestation of evil.
Well, don't, right.
you got a pen, Jordan? You want to write that down?
Yeah. Just, Americans pretty much covers that, actually. Well, yeah, right. The question that Gabe asks is, what are you people?
Yeah.
And her answer is, we're Americans. You know, which I thought, you know, I love when answers, it's so satisfying to me in a horror movie when a question is answered, mm-hmm. but it only remains scary if the answer raises new questions to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think you walk into this movie thinking, okay, what is this, a supernatural thing? And there's part of it that is supernatural, this idea of the soul and the magic side of it. But I wanted to have a moment where she declares, you know, pretty early on without saying these words, like, look, we're from here.
Yeah.
We're human beings that are from this soil.
Yeah.
Which of course you go on to find out, oh yes, they are. They're just underneath it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously this, the imagery in this movie is, based on my fear of the American society, whereas I think us can apply to anybody, you know, human beings in general, your family, your country, and so for me it was my country, and the duality of our society.
Yeah. At what point did you realize you were going to write that?
That line?
Yeah.
It was in there. You know, I always thought, like, oh, this is probably, they're going to want to do this for the trailer moment, you know, and I'm always bringing that up, but they're, you know, some reason they're like, yeah, you know, I don't know. You know, I'm sure their research has good reasons. People don't want to see a movie about them. Damn Americans.
Who wants to see that?
Yeah, who wants to see that?
Unbelievable. There is a supernatural element here, obviously, but the end speech, that amazing shot, that sort of De Palma-esque sort of split diopter shot you have, where obviously it's not because Lupita can't clone herself. I don't think she can clone herself anyway, you know, but that amazing shot.
We still
shot.
Did it with a split diopter.
Really?
Because we use doubles.
Okay.
You know, so...
Oh, you didn't fake it? No, I thought it was maybe CG or something.
It was. Like, yeah, it was CG.
Okay.
But we still initially shoot it with a split diopter on both sides and feel that, but yes, then we have to VFX it together.
Excellent. It's a fantastic shot. And
thank you.
In that moment, in that speech, she lays out an awful lot of stuff to unpack. One of which is the reference to the idea that the tethered, there's some sort of connection to humans. That humans built what you call the underpass.
Yes.
And this, since we're maybe getting into territory you don't want to explore, we'll say. But can you talk a little bit about that connection between humans and the tethered, and the idea that they've been left there, marooned there by someone or something?
Well, you know, I can say, you know, without going into who exactly those humans were,
okay,
which I think is something the audience can put together, imagine, and have the tools to create acceptable answers. I think I wanted to at least inform us in some way that humanity is behind this abomination.
Yes.
Or that at least this the queen of the underpass's belief was that this happened. See what I did there?
Yeah, I did. I saw that.
So, but you know, it's part of my kind of ongoing thesis that we are the monsters that we're trying to portray in these monster movies, in these horror films. It's us, and the point of horror to me is that, you know, we can't go unchecked. We can't, when we don't face our fears, or when we suppress our guilt, I think, you know, we end up committing atrocities together. Yeah. So, you know, and this, obviously, this is, you know, this part of this this movie that is addressing the conspiracy theories of government mind control and
fluoride in the water.
In the water. Yeah. And I thought, wouldn't that be a really, if there was a group of humans that was powerful enough to create this labyrinth, would they not be the same people to try to use the tether to control, to puppeteer, essentially.
Puppeteer. Yeah. It sounds to me, and you said you have a mythology worked out for this movie, it sounds to me that this is something you might want to explore a little bit further.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, right now I'm not like, I'm not trying to plan it. I leave it open so that if when Universal comes to me and says, we'll give you $100 million right now to do an Us 2, I can jump in there. But I've got a bunch of stories to tell.
Is that what it would take, $100 million?
It would take $100 million. Let's mark it right now. That's what it would be. No, right. No. Honestly, the beauty of this movie, in terms of where your imagination can go, mm-hmm. is that it's fairly endless. You know, I mean, the,
like, what happens to that human chain? What do they do when they suddenly break hands and? Yeah. Exist in what's left of the world. I mean,
it's a big story, and I think there's a lot of different ways to approach continuing in this universe that are at the very least fun in my mind and computer.
Well, if you needed a Kickstarter, I've got $10.
You got $10 on it?
I've just gone back from America yesterday, so I've got
$10 on it.
All right, yeah, 15, great. 15. All right, all right. Okay, you got it.
Now we're talking.
Now we're good. I'd like to talk about the orchestral rendition of I Got Five on It. Point did you realize that was going to?
You know, the in the initial script, it was Tchaikovsky's Pas de Deux at the end of The Nutcracker,
okay.
which would have been the music that Adelaide was danced to at 14.
Yeah.
And we put that in the first cut, and it wasn't working.
Oh, really?
It I mean, to me, as a viewer, it felt sort of old school, a little bit pretentious, even. Like, I'm really like, I listen to Tchaikovsky on a regular basis, and I'm like, oh yeah, let's try this piece of music, this class. So, you know, then I've always thought that I Got Five on It had this haunting, you know, this is why we used the track in the first place. It had this haunting lick to it, or whatever you call it, sounded kind of like Angelo Baldamente's score for Nightmare on Elm Street. At the same time as being a total just banger, you know. And so, is that the right use of banger? That's a very British.
It's totally fine.
I don't know.
I will allow it.
Okay. The idea came to. Have Michael sort of go off in his live strings and sort of deconstruct that song.
We only got a couple of minutes left, and so I want to get into, I guess, the movie's big twist, which is the reveal that Adelaide is red and red is Adelaide. And there was a switch at the beginning of the movie. Can you talk about that and where that idea came from and misdirecting audiences, because again, it's something that you set up. There's a couple of shots early on of young Adelaide post abduction, where, you know, her parents are going to the therapist, and there's a seed planted there, and then you misdirect people again away from it and bring it back right at the end.
Mm-hmm. You know, this movie's about maybe the monster is you. Mm-hmm. It's about us kind of looking at ourselves as individuals and as a group. And, you know, the protagonist in a movie is the surrogate for the audience. Mm-hmm. So it felt like at the end of the day, I wasn't doing my core theme any justice if I wasn't, you know, revealing that we have been the bad guy in this movie. We've been we've been following the villain. You know, I say villain lightly because, you know, as you know, I think there are many experiences of the film, and I think a lot of people go through a question of what is good and evil. Who is is that, does that even exist? Both characters are lovable and terrifying based on the lives they've led. They've just sort of inverted their paths.
The real Adelaide is forced into a path that is ultimately, she, you know, commits atrocities, a huge atrocity on a possibly global scale, mm-hmm. because of something that happened to her when she was a kid she had no control over. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the real Red is someone who has made a choice, upwardly climbed in a way. She's become, you know, a little bit more socially aware. And is that a bad thing necessarily? It comes from a bad place.
Well, she did kidnap a little girl.
She did kidnap a little girl, precisely. Precisely. But if you get past
that, she's put 1 foot forward and made a good life for herself.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I think one of the questions is raised is privilege.
Yeah.
You know, the neglect that you know, sort of presumption of deserved privilege kind of requires, and when people are on the other side of it, when people are in have received the rough end of the nurture argument, and they rebel or act in violence or commit crimes on that side, is that evil or is that circumstance?
And is this something that you set up in a way from the very beginning? The first shot of the film is Adelaide reflected, her dark mm-hmm. reflection in a way. Is that clearly, was that deliberate on your part? And can you talk about also the last shot? I'm fascinated by when filmmakers know when to end films and on what shot. And the final shot is Adelaide / Red smiling as Jason begins to, I think, understand what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that? About
well,
that
the real last shot, of course, is
yes.
the,
of course, yes.
is the
yes.
line. But you're kind of interested in that exchange.
Yeah.
So in the first question, that was very an intentional reflection, seeing the girl you know, with her scissors cutting the paper dolls while watching.
Yeah.
And everything that she's going to use in her expression and her journey toward the end of the film is kind of in there in that scene somehow. You can't do that shot. That shot's impossible, right? Because you would see the camera.
Yeah.
So we did a little bit of our movie magic there. Okay. But and also, nice little fun fact is the you know, the Muzak that's playing over the Hands Across America commercial mm-hmm. is LaFleur. It's the song that we kick in full in our final Hands Across America. But yes, okay, Adelaide and Jason.
Yeah.
Sort of sharing that moment at the end, you know, I'm purposefully leaving it a bit vague as to mm-hmm. what exactly he knows or mm-hmm. how far he's come in figuring out what if anything he's figured out,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I think the little moment she has is not, you know, the little smile she gives him mm-hmm. is a I think it's a lot of things. I think it's I think it's a connection to the evil smile she once had as a little girl,
uh-huh.
but also a sort of like understanding that that, you know, her family was her family unit was stronger from this experience.
Mm. And it is interesting that the family unit in this movie, yeah, there's widespread slaughter, You killed Tim Heidecker, for God's sake. I mean, yeah. Come on, man.
I mean, what's, yeah.
It's twice.
Very easy to do.
But the family unit here stays intact. You put them through all sorts of peril. Yeah. Was that always on the cards? Did you have any iterations where maybe Gabe didn't quite make it? Or
No. I've sort of learned my lesson, after the first initial screenings of Get Out way back when Chris went to jail, that, look, the audience doesn't need it to be a squeaky clean happy ending, but mm-hmm. they, part of respecting them is knowing certain boundaries of where you'll lose them. And yeah, that's a family we need to survive.
On that note, Jordan, it's been a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend.
Great questions.
Okay, so that was Jordan Peele. Now it's time for us to get into, us. I wrote the Empire review of this movie. I love this film. I gave it 4 stars, and I said in the podcast the other night on Friday, I'm not entirely sure why I held back from giving it the 5th, because I think it deserves it. It's a fantastic film. And Terry, you saw it twice over the weekend.
I did. Once at 11 a.m. on Saturday, while a kids' party happened in the cinema upstairs.
Wow.
So it was just me and 4 other people in the Everyman in Hampstead. Other cinema chains are available. And the kids running around screaming certainly added something. And then I watched it again on Sunday, and my brain has been scrambled and I'm basically bamboozled.
Okay.
In a really amazing way. I think it's a masterpiece, I have to say.
Ooh. Masterpiece.
I really do. And I've seen some kind of third biggest, I think we saw the box office last night, biggest debut for a horror ever. And I think there's been some unfair comparisons in places to Get Out. I think it philosophically and just as a piece of craft, I think it's next level from Get Out.
Interesting. Very interesting. John, where do you stand on this film?
It's funny. I think I had a similar sort of journey, if mm-hmm. to use a sort of pompous word, as you did, Chris. I think I came out of it thinking, yeah, that was really good. I think that's a 4-star film. And the more I've thought about it, it's really burrowed into my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And
like
I can't,
a rabbit.
Like a rabbit mm. might. Yep. I think it's a 5-star now for me. I really think it's something that grows with you. And I think I had the same relationship with Get Out as well. I think that's something that sort of gets better as you rewatch mm. it. And it deserves rewatches. Like, it's built for rewatches.
Yeah.
I saw it in the sort of big press screening at the Cineworld IMAX in Leicester Square, which was a fantastic venue for it. Absolute huge screen, booming sound. The sound in this movie is incredible. Mm. And that was a great experience, but I'm really keen to see it again in a cinema like Peckinplex, where the crowd
it's
just
very
goes
specific.
It is very specific. Well, it's because it's near where I live, and I saw Get Out there, and that was.
And where do you live again, John? Your exact address and postcode, please. You're great. And while you're at it, your PIN number and your the code in the back of the card.
I live in South London.
Where? I think I saw that once on the news.
I saw Get Out at Peckinplex, and it was just the best experience.
Are you sponsored by the Peckinplex, John?
It's £5, £4.99 a ticket, all films.
Okay.
And people just go nuts. If you see it at a weekend, everyone gets involved, especially in a film like this. People will just, when I saw Get Out, they're like, no, don't go through there. Don't go in there. It was like participation cinema. It was amazing. Is that too much?
Well, they're the ushers. don't go in there. That's my little pony playing in there. Go in there. That's where Get Out is. Very helpful, ushers. Very helpful indeed. Before we begin, permission to retroactively add a 5th star to the
fuck it, why not? Rules are made to be broken, especially when I disagree.
Yeah. Yeah, I figured that. Because I think this is absolutely terrific. And I rewatched it last night. I went with my wife, Mrs. Drink Again. We went to the Greenwich Picture House, John. And decent audience, decent crowd for a Sunday night movie as well, which was good. And she loved it. And I was watching it this time around with the knowledge of, obviously the big twist in the movie, but also having spoken specifically to Jordan Peele about certain things and certain symbols and recurring motifs and themes in the movie, I was looking out for things this time around. Recurrences, for example, of rabbits, mm-hmm. Recurrences of the number 1111, which happens a lot during the movie. Obviously, first time around I spotted a few, but this time around I spotted more. And obviously the Adelaide red conundrum and that old big old twistaroo. But the second time around, I thought it absolutely played again like gangbusters. I can see how perhaps some people have been either baffled or left slightly cold by the third act.
Yes.
And maybe that's something we should get into right now. Terry, so you this movie reset your brain, scrambled it, reset it, the whole thing. Was the third act a big part of that?
The third act was, but I mean the construction of the whole thing. So there was a bit where I was midway through the film and I thought, and it felt like you were in the final act, but then my brain worked out we were not even halfway through the movie. So it does a shift, you know, it sets it up as a home invasion movie, essentially. It really reminded me of Funny Games, the American Michael Haneke, and it also
And the original, I guess, as well.
Yes, but I'm classless, so I'm specifically referring to the to the American version.
Okay.
And also, it really reminded me of The Strangers, because actually that's almost identical, where they turn up outside and they've got the masks on. And you kind of know that it's going to go different places because it's Jordan Peele and it's ostensibly a horror film. But the way the third act plays out, which I know has split some people, I mean, there's some sequences in there. There's basically Black Swan in there, done in like much better in about 3.5 minutes. I mean, it fundamentally makes you question kind of everything you think you believe, where you think the rights and wrongs sits, kind of your own moral compass as well as everybody in the film.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. And without jumping to kind of what we ultimately think it represents, I think the whole, what you come away with is a sense of, for me, it's all about fractured identity and otherness in society. And it asks some massive, 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 massive intellectual and philosophical questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's arguably one of the first truly politicised films in the Trump era. A lot of films have been kind of given that tag, but probably weren't even, you know, had been developed before Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
as a kind of a statement on modern America, it raises some fascinating things.
Mm-hmm. Trump is everywhere for me in movies. Dumbo is out this week, and it's very hard to look at Michael Keaton's character in that movie with his hair that's been basically painted onto his head, and he's this vainglorious billionaire. It's hard not to see Donald Trump in that, but I'm sure that was just a happenstance. That was just a coincidence, but you're absolutely right. This was conceived, written, and made in the last, year and a half, really. So, yeah, Trump is definitely on Jordan Peele's mind with this movie.
It's quite deliberate, the fact that it's us, and also, you know, that could be read as US. Like, this is very much
what?
A sort of...
Whoa!
Let me just blow your mind.
The blower of the morning.
Thank you. No, it's obviously very much a sort of satire on America and, you know, what America should be. That I mean, as you mentioned in the interview, that sort of symbolic line, "We're Americans," is like... Mm. That feels like the most important moment of the whole film in some ways. Like, this is like, these are Americans as a literal underclass.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating what he's done. I read some mad reactions on Twitter, people saying like, I think he just made a home invasion movie, and then he was like, maybe I'll just chuck in this subtext as an afterthought. And like, it's not an afterthought at all. It's the very, it's the home invasion thing almost feels like a sort of vehicle to get these ideas through, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I was completely and utterly surprised by the movie, because I saw the first trailer when it came out a few months ago, and I thought, I'm not watching anything else from this movie until I sit down and see it. So if I recall correctly, the first trailer really focused on the home invasion stuff.
Mm.
So everything else that comes afterwards, where the scope of the movie is opened almost imperceptibly outwards, was new to me. And the idea that it almost becomes a zombie apocalypse movie. Towards the end, I said to Jordan Peele, this feels almost, it feels John Carpenter-y in a way. It feels like the fourth part of John Carpenter's Apocalypse trilogy. Little bits and pieces of Prince of Darkness seep into this film. So I was stunned by that stuff. But yeah, the idea of the tethered and that line, "We're Americans," which floored me. That was fascinating to me, because it is a movie, again, that's something you've heard Jordan Peele say. It's about many, many things, but it's also about privilege, and it's about the apathy of privilege, and about how on our daily walk to work we will walk past homeless people, for example. Sometimes we'll pay them not a second thought. This is also about that sort of the rise of that politically angry class of people, the Trump supporters,
either side of the Brexit divide, the people who are angry enough about, you know, to go to protests, and that sort of attitude fomenting over the last few years, and how it's very easy to ignore that, and it's very easy to be complacent about that until suddenly you're in the middle of an uprising and you don't know which way to turn.
Because it's also about the randomness of privilege, right? Literally your position. It's not who you are, it's as much where you are. So yeah. Whether you're above ground or underground, that dictates so much of who you are. And the fact that actually it was one of the tethered who was living above there the entire time and has developed a human life. So it calls into question the very nature of otherness, which is actually given the right path, the escalator going the other way instead of that one way, which again is not the most subtle of metaphors, right? The fact that there's only the escalator going down is pretty much the only thing keeping them from uprising.
Sorry, just to jump in there, the escalator, I did read a bit of Trump in there, perhaps. Like, as soon as I saw this sort of escalator, I couldn't help but think Trump's like announcement speech where he like literally descends on a golden escalator at Trump Tower.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe there's nothing there, but I thought that imagery was quite interesting.
But at the very least, it's how the very basics are stacked against people, right? Which is you don't even have a mode of getting up from there. And just the randomness of that privilege. And she had the life that actually had been intended for Red. And it's confusing with the names, right? And I think for probably ease of understanding, we'll use Red for all the tethers.
Red will be Red!
Red will be Red.
And Adelaide will be Adelaide.
So I think that kind of perception of them and us, and as you say, Chris, you know, we're in really strange political times, but really kind of a political time which feels binary in many respects, but also that sense of there being a good gang and a bad gang has kind of disappeared, at least in this country, definitely.
Should we get into the Red and Adelaide thing and the twist of the movie? And it's also, I think it's really, really interesting how it plays with audiences' perception of heroism and villainy. First of all, did anyone see it coming?
I mean, I think I did. I think it wasn't like the most surprising thing for me. And I just thought there were a couple of elements that were slightly telegraphed. I think maybe that might have been deliberate on Jordan Peele's part. There's, you know, a few moments where I think Lupita Nyong'o's speech as Adelaide is a little bit more jittery, you know, like there's little clues that perhaps she suggests that she's not who she says she is.
Mm-hmm.
And then those scenes in the prologue sort of don't really, like it's not left totally clear who's who. Like, you know, there is some deliberate ambiguity there at the start. So it wasn't a huge surprise, but that didn't mean it was any less satisfying. Like, it felt like a really satisfying twist and a really clever way to end the film on a sort of ambiguous note.
Someone actually tweeted in, I can't find your name, so sorry, to say that they thought something was up whenever Adelaide was teaching Jason in the car to click his fingers to
yes.
I Got Five on It.
I noticed
and she
that.
Was slightly off the beat.
Yeah.
And he said, did you notice that? Because that, and it's like, dude, I've got no rhythm whatsoever. Everything is off beat for me. So no, I didn't notice it. There are a couple of little things, you know, there, if you go back and look at the film again, I actually think there's a moment where it's blindingly obvious and he's almost beating you over the head with it really, really early on when you see young Adelaide, who by that point is now young Red. Her parents are at the psychotherapist and they're talking about how she had a traumatic experience and she's not speaking and she's playing with some animals, and one of those animals is a rabbit. She places a rabbit right in the middle of this lineup of animals as well. And that's the point where I almost think he's going, They've swapped. And really, narratively, and from a storytelling point of view, that's the only option you can go for from that very, very early confrontation. What he does, I think, which is so masterful and was so artful as well, is that he steers you away from that. He shows you very, very early on in the credit sequence, rabbits. That lineup of rabbits. Mm-hmm. And then later on, he shows you a scene which suggests very strongly that Adelaide is actually a doppelganger. And then he mounts the rest of the action in such a way and that he almost makes you forget about that until the revelation at the end.
I agree. And I have to say that it was only during the final kind of face-off scene that the penny fully dropped for me. There was a moment I suspected, and the moment I suspected was during one of the fight sequences around the house, one of the first ones. Adelaide made a noise during, I can't remember who she was killing, and she made a noise, and I was like, hang on.
Yeah, so she kills one of the teenagers.
Yes, yeah. And the noise she makes is the noise. The animalistic noise. And I was like, hang on. And then, as you say, I got so distracted, and it never kind of was raised again. Watching it second time round, that moment in the doctor's office where she looks like, you know, she's been possessed by an evil spirit, at the very least, I'm like, that probably should have been a bit of a clue, Terry. Like, she's literally sat in the, like, evil devil eyes, massive, you know, unless he put an arrow over her head going, not the real one, he probably couldn't have done anything. And it seems obvious, but it was still... And what John's saying is really interesting, because I almost like shoved it to the back of my brain. And then when the reveal happened, I still went, oh, like with such kind of dramatic intent, because he played it. The way I think he unfolds it is really interesting and precise.
Yeah.
And that moment of the reveal is stunning. And I like you, found it immensely, immensely satisfying.
And the way as well, there's, I think you see little clues in the, I think, is it Jason the son? Mm-hmm. He sort of picks up on things. So that moment where she lets out that scream, and he sort of gives her a look as if to say, who the hell are you? You know, there's these little sort of suspicious glances he gives her. And then that obviously reaches ahead in the car in the sort of final scene.
Yeah, but I don't know that he's necessarily...
I don't know if he's figured it out.
I think he's figuring something out, but I also think he's the kid in the family who most obviously wears a mask. I don't think it's a problem for him. I think he just looks at his mum as someone who's wearing another mask. She's still his mum. It's about identity, ultimately. And young Red supplants young Adelaide's identity, and then, to all intents and purposes, becomes Adelaide, forges her own life, becomes human, falls in love, becomes the person we're rooting for, and Red goes the other way. It's almost like Trading Places in a weird way. So, you know, Red becomes Dan Aykroyd, who's at his lowest ebb in the Santa costume, wearing with a smoked salmon in his beard, and Adelaide is Eddie Murphy, who's living the life of Riley. So this is a weirdly twisted remake of Trading Places, I've just realised.
But I'm sold on it. But, you know, I read the Jason thing slightly differently. So I his face in the scene in the ambulance at the end, where he looks at her and he knows for sure, right? And she does that kind of terrifying half smile. And maybe I've been thinking about this too much this weekend, but I was thinking it's really about generational sin, and, you know, and about how the kind of being absolved of the sins of the forefathers, and how those are passed on through the generations. And actually, she's now really fucked up her kid, and she's kind of planted the sin in the next generation. It will continue going on. American history is built on generations of sin and misdeeds, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how I read the Jason thing. And I thought he seemed scared at the end, and a little bit like his new path was starting, his new path that was being shaped out of the sins of his mum. Because as you say, it is his mum at that point. She gave birth to him. Mm-hmm. And she married his dad, and all of that is her real life, even if she swapped identities at the beginning.
Some people have talked about plot holes and logical fallacies in this movie, and I don't see any issue with any of them, really. I kind of like that there's a lot that's unexplained. But the thing that I can't quite get my head around is that Adelaide is the tethered, right? So we are to believe that she has no soul.
Well,
is that she is. It's all one soul.
It's a shared soul. There's a line where they say they could duplicate the bodies, but they could only have one soul. Okay. And that's the thing, is their soul is split across two bodies, one above ground, right, one below ground.
Yeah. I was just trying to, because it's such a strange thought to think what kind of life she had to forge to sort of go from being this sort of slightly twisted, weird underground monster person into becoming like a fully functioning member of society.
But isn't that the point, though, that they actually could be seen as victims? They're part of a government experiment to try and control the people above ground. They're abandoned at some point in such a horrible way that they have to eat and kill those rabbits and eat the rabbits. That's pretty much at one point is hinted at that that's their only food down there. They're left to rot down there, and instead of, you know, God knows what, doing something else with them, they're just left to exist and presumably die down there. And so actually, when you see this film for the second time through that prism, and you see them as victims of society and this need to kind of control people, and this split between opportunity and no opportunity and affluence, and when you start to see it in those terms, I didn't see them as kind of bad people being kept underground, but victims of essentially societal and government control.
Mm-hmm. A few people have said things like, you know, why couldn't they just go up to the surface.
The escalator.
The escalator. And just, well, no, but when they emerge on the surface, they emerge obviously with vengeance and a takeover on their mind. Why can't we all just get along? Because they've, I think, over the years, they've grown to hate, especially, I think, fostered by Adelaide's very real rage at being supplanted in her life by this little girl, that they have a very, very real hatred towards their other halves as well.
When you look at what they're doing down there, the actions they're performing, there's that scene where it cuts to what's happening upstairs and what's happening downstairs, and their version is punching walls, and you know, everything's a bit off and a bit twisted, and the kind of darkness that's attached to that, they've clearly been living some kind of hell for decades and decades and decades. And actually, so of course, when they find the chosen one or whatever they perceive it to be, and obviously there's a lot of religious symbolism in this film as well, they are doing it with vengeance and with righteous anger. And I think if I'd been buried below ground, like living a shitter version of somebody else's life, I'd be probably a bit pissed off and all.
Absolutely. It's why Adelaide is so important, young Adelaide coming amongst them, because she's not of the tethered. So therefore she knows, A, that there's a way out. And there's a line that Red/Adelaide has towards, that's called Red, towards the end, it has, "We were born special." So there's even an indication that Red herself, as a young tethered, is somehow different from the other tethered, because she finds a way out. Yes. Whereas the other tethered seem mindless in a way. They're copies, but she has free thought in a way that the others don't.
She's
she can find a way out.
Speak as well, right?
Well, she learns that eventually. Learns, yeah. She, you know, she learns it from her environment around her. But at the beginning of the movie, she can't speak. Mm. Last night we watched it again, I was like, well, how come Adelaide just doesn't wake up and go, well, hang on, I'm not one of you? But there's that little throwaway thing where she wakes up and she's been strangled and her voice box may be slightly damaged. I mean, let's just go with that. Let's just go with it. There are other things about the origin of the Tethered. Jordan Peele didn't really want to get into everything. He wants, again, to leave it up to the viewer's imaginations. Or he hasn't figured it out. Either way works. It's totally fine. But one of them is the origin. There's that line about, you know, obviously they were man-made in some way, that it was some sort of government experiment to see whether you could clone people, yes, but also whether you could clone the soul. And so I'm wondering if there was some sort of, because it raises a lot of questions. The end of the film, the very final shot of the film, with that huge Hands Across America, the almost bastardization of Hands Across America in a weird way, that massive political statement that they're making, here we are, we are the tethered, you can't ignore us now, you bastards, that last shot lays bare the scale of this thing. And you're wondering, how big is this? So is this a global crisis? Are there tethered, does everybody have a tethered, does everybody have a twin, or is it just a government experiment in America localized to Santa Cruz or roughly around that area? And it's just a few thousand.
I thought it was national, but American. And that's because when I considered it being global, A, there's the line, we're Americans, although arguably that could be happening in another country and they could be saying, we are French, in a French accent. I think it is national. And actually, the opening words are really the thing that confirmed that for me. So obviously, the text on the beginning of the screen, before the, either was it after the credits or before the credits? Anyway, it says that there is a network of underground tunnels, etc., etc. And it makes it clear that he's speaking about the US when he's talking about those tunnels. Yeah. Mm. So that for me made it feel like it's definitely bigger than just Santa Cruz, but it's an American problem, and it works as an allegory for America. I think you can put a kind of global view on it as well, but that's kind of where I ended upon that last shot, that it was nationwide across the states.
My reading of that is that there was an experiment to try and somehow find the soul and clone the soul, and it went awry a little bit, and maybe the souls began to manifest themselves physically in an attempt to somehow puppeteer the people above the surface. And again, you know, that's something that we're reading an awful lot about these days as well, the idea of government control and, you know, subliminal messaging. And there's a line from Sora early in the movie about fluoride in the water, and she says nobody cares about the end of the world. By the end of the movie, they kind of do. And I again, that indicates where he's going with it. It's very clever. There are lots of little subtle foreshadowings and you know, setups for payoffs that come later. So my feeling is that the souls physically manifested in an attempt to puppeteer the people on the surface, but it didn't work. And in actual fact, it's the people on the surface who puppeteer the people below, which is why they are in such abject misery. Because, for example, Adelaide's dad, his doppelganger doesn't want to be punching walls. And the people who are on the roller coaster, they don't want to be huddled in a doorway pretending that they're on a roller coaster. They're the other way around. Which is, again, why Adelaide is different. Because Adelaide, in a way, young Adelaide, can, in a way, puppeteer to an extent above ground.
Well, that's
Adelaide.
The key scene, isn't it? When they're doing the dance recital,
yes.
It's indicated that it's Red who's actually leading that dance, and therefore that's the time that everybody underground goes, hang on, I don't quite know. That's the bit I was the leap with. How do they know that she's the one controlling it? I don't know if it's the dance was so beautiful that she clearly wasn't being dragged around, because the way they did the movements of the tethered normally, and the stuff you just described, I found really traumatizing. That shot of people stood in a doorway being thrown around as if they were on a roller coaster, and they look terrified and just full of horror. And actually, when you see Red dance and Adelaide above ground, Red is beautiful. It is very Black Swan-esque. And that's the moment they go, oh my God, we may be able to have control, or at least this one person amongst us can control what goes on above ground as well. And that's the moment they decide she's the Messiah or the one or whatever they ultimately, because there's that scene where they literally go and stand around her, and it looks very much like a laying hands on church. Yeah. Thing. I don't know what the correct word is for
they anoint her as her leader. Yes. It's almost a baptism in a way. And Jordan Peele even uses the word Messiah to describe Adelaide/Red.
And there is some sort of biblical dialogue as well, isn't there? Like, she talks about being sent from God or something like that.
She talks about having seen God, and in that dance, that was the moment that she saw God.
Right.
I want to ask about the knowledge of Adelaide and Red. Because I've seen a few people, we had a few questions from people going, does Adelaide know that she was once a tethered? And does Red know that she was once a surface dweller, a human, so to speak? What do you think?
Well, so I don't think so. I read something saying that essentially Adelaide starts to remember more, and she's not aware for most of the film. I don't read it like that at all. I read it that she was basically worried about being discovered. So I felt like she had consciousness of what she'd done as a child throughout the entire film. So when she's jittery and worried and closing the curtains and doesn't want to go back to the beach, that for me is about her protecting this life. She doesn't want to go back and be a tethered. But I know lots of other people said they felt like she was remembering more, and there's a moment of realisation for her. I thought both of them knew exactly what had happened, and that's kind of what drove both their motivations narratively throughout the whole film.
It just means that no one lays it out explicitly. So that first time when they meet in that great scene in the house, where all four of them are lined up opposite each other, and God, the writing's so they're so good. Talking about setting up things and then paying them off later on. So, you know, Umbre is introduced. Red says that she was brought into this world laughing, and she goes out laughing. Pluto, which I think didn't get a chance to talk about this with Jordan Peele, but Pluto, I think, is a nod to The Hills of Eyes, in which another normal American family meets a unnormal American family, and shit happens. And there's a major character in that called Pluto as well. And Pluto, you know, she talks about how he was born out of fire, and that's how he dies. He dies in the fire as well. So, you know, it's just a wonderful, intricate, clockwork script. It's absolutely beautiful. But yeah, I think it's they never really explicitly have that conversation amongst themselves. Even at the end, when Red is laying out the exposition that you would think Adelaide would already know, she becomes Red exposition for a little bit. That's interesting that they never really explicitly come out. She never says, you took my life, you stole what was mine.
Yeah, I wonder if that is more sort of careful filmmaking, that it's not revealing too much to the audience and saving the twist for the end, rather than any specific like characters stuff where she's there. If they were having that sort of, you know, explicit confrontation, I think I haven't seen this twice, but I think watching Lupita Nyong'o's performance again,
oh, she's so good.
My God.
I think there is some guilt there, probably. I think there is some sort of like,
oh yeah,
some long held guilt that she's like had to deal with her whole life, and then this is her chickens coming home to roost sort of thing.
It's what Terry said about the sins of the past. Right. She's aware of what she's done, and then suddenly it is there, manifested in front of her, very vengeful, terrifying, red overalls, looking like some sort of demented quick fit fitter. with those scissors. And then suddenly, yeah, you're right, the chickens have come home to roost. Yeah. Like, yeah, even the way she shuts, tries to shut Gabe up, and he's like trying to be quite friendly, or placate them. She's going, Gabe, because she knows she's from the Tethered. She knows what they can do, and she knows what they're capable of, and she knows that for the most part, they're mindless husks, except for the person sitting in front of her. Why is she not a mindless husk? Because I stole her life. She used to be me. I used to be her. A lot of people have been talking about the logistical difficulty of planning a nationwide uprising. Where did they get the overalls from? Where did they get the scissors from? Someone wrote in saying that you can't subsist on a rabbit-only diet, especially when it's just raw and bloody. You've got no cooking utensils or kitchens or anything like that. But at that point, that's where the supernatural kicks in. This is a supernatural manifestation, and so I think we're allowed a few liberties with that. Also, Amazon Prime will deliver anywhere.
And we only see one part of downstairs, let's not forget, right? We don't know if they have they've been at this
scissor
for,
room.
They might have a scissor room. They might have a red overall room. They've been at this for decades, right? So if you think about her dance recital, she must have been a teenager. When she's above ground, the kind of, it's what, 30 however many years later, right? So they've been at this for probably 2 decades roughly,
32 years later.
And during that time, that's probably how long it would take to plan and execute a national uprising on that scale. And I just want to mention the scene you were just talking about Jordan Peele planting those amazing little echoes that come back later in the film. Also, the levity in that scene is beautiful. A lot of that comes through Gabe, but you know, the bit where he's like trying to barter with them, clearly not understanding what's happening. And he like offers them the boat, and Zora goes, "Dad, nobody wants the boat." And I just thought the confidence of Jordan Peele to write those scenes, which are full of tension and full of jeopardy and high stakes, and it's just some beautifully timed. I mean, the cinema I was in, there was 5 of us, and all of those little lines got a big laugh. And often, you know, it's so hard to do without completely undercutting the tension, but I just thought it was beautiful because you have to be invested in each member of that family to keep going through another, you know, leg and a half of the film. And actually, he spends so long at the beginning setting up these characters who you feel so warm about. The family dynamic is captured so brilliantly, the little asides, you know, there's no kind of, it's not just exposition after kind of laden dialogue after, there's just the normal back and forwards of a family, and I just think the time spent doing that is so important to this film.
I love that moment where they compare kill counts.
My god, and who's going to drive, that whole thing about who's going to drive,
and the Home Alone reference.
God,
we're not going to sprinkle micro machines on the floor, like, what's a micro machine?
what's home alone?
That's the most terrifying line in the film.
Yeah.
Who doesn't know what Home Alone is? It's a terrible Christmas movie. That's what it is.
It's a fun... Oh, Chris, we've got a serious discussion to be had after this.
You prefer Home Alone 2, don't you?
Home Alone 2 is superior, but
which has
both...
Donald Trump in it.
What?
Yes.
So it all,
they're both fantastic.
Feeds in,
they're both
it?
Masterpieces of American cinema.
And dropping in Fuck the Police by NWA. the timing in this film is beautiful and perfection.
Possibly best use of Beach Boys as well. I mean, good vibrations in that moment is great. I want to talk a little bit more about Adelaide and Red, because there's an awful lot of there's that shot we were talking about how he basically has a finger and arrow pointing at young Adelaide, going, "This is actually Red. This is actually Red." But there's lots of his images, and his use of imagery is fantastic. There's an awful lot of scenes shot through in mirrors and reflections of Adelaide, which clearly indications that there's something up here. You know, obviously, you know, highlighting the nature of the duality of that character, but also I think saying there's something up with this character. This is not necessarily who you think she is. The opening shot of the movie is Adelaide's reflection, captured in that TV set. So it's right there, right from the off. This character, you think you're with this character, but really we're going to be focusing on the shadow world variation of this character, which I think is pretty cool. That opening scene, also that push in the TV set, has the TV show is 11 at 11, so there's 11:11 right from the off. And if you look at the videotapes around the TV as well, you have The Right Stuff. So another cameo of The Right Stuff this year. Well done, The Right Stuff is doing well, making a bit of a comeback. But also two of the films on there are Chud, and The Goonies, both of which are about subterranean dwellers in a way.
Yeah.
But also his first, I read that his first girlfriend's dad directed Chud. And so that was like a bit of a personal nod from him. I don't quite know what that means, but
that's kind of amazing. And it references all the way through to other horror films. I mentioned The Hills of Eyes. I mentioned Prince of Darkness. There's nods to Hitchcock in there. There's obviously nods to The Lost Boys. You have to imagine that that's the film that is filming at Santa Cruz Boardwalk. You know, they mentioned earlier on, go and be an extra in that film they're shooting over there. That must be The Lost Boys. Mm. He's such a horror aficionado that it's all packed in there. And, you know, it could take weeks to unpack all the different references and whatnot in this movie.
I felt some Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, the people in tunnels and basements. And, you know, he was obviously set on, well, he was, you know, a bad guy, but he was set on fire by a vengeful mob. There's so many amazing, and a lot of them quite delicate, actually, from kind of 80s classics to loads of horror. As you say, that Hitchcockian tension is kind of there all the way through. Romero, you can feel. The second time I was a little bit like, spot the Easter egg and spot the reference. Yeah.
I mean, he's very cine literate, isn't he? I thought there was a little bit of The Shining in the sort of steady cam shot in the opening prologue.
Yes.
Yeah. That sort of tracking a small child, that felt very Shining.
The twins.
The twins, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, visually as well.
He looks beautiful.
It's stunning. I mean, he's a very precise filmmaker narratively, but also visually. I think there's some really like clear-minded and sort of very careful placements of the camera. And we've got to really give a shout out to Mike Giolakis, the cinematographer, who just did such an amazing job in lighting this film and giving it this really sort of distinct visual sheen. The stuff at night when the home invasion happens looks incredible. The shadows and the lights from behind. The way he shoots the Hall of Mirrors in the prologue, I think, is incredible. And Mike Giolakis also did Under the Silver Lake this year, which, and you know, for people are mixed on that film, I think. But it has a similar sort of satire on America. It shows America in a sort of real but hyper real way, in a really clever way. I think he's, you know, a really talented cinematographer.
I also think this film's meticulously designed, isn't it? But I also think that the score is fantastic. The Michael Abel score, he is pretty much brand new in the scene, as far as I can tell. He did Get Out as well as this movie, and it's encouraging because it means that there's some great new voices out there in the world of film scoring. And I love the sort of COD Omen-y, almost Ave Zantani kind of
the
choir at the beginning of the movie, which I think is almost there as a red herring in a weird way, you know, push you into thinking that this is about
evil rabbits,
but ultimately it makes you think it's about angels and demons and good versus evil in a very biblical sense.
Right,
and there's a biblical overtone to this movie, obviously, but ultimately it's about internal evil and internal good, and you know, that battle rages within us all.
And the sort of classical remix of Five on It is just genius.
So one of the interesting things about this movie is that Peele himself has said that it's not about race in the overt way that Get Out was, and it's really refreshing. Even though he said it's not overtly about race, it's really refreshing, and he deliberately positioned a black family of middle class affluent African Americans in there, but at the same time they also want what Josh and Kitty have. This kind of horrible, nasty, phenol family, but they have a better house, a better car, a better boat, which is called Biatch, by the way, if you didn't pick that up. And so it is still about, even though you get to this level, this sort of strata of society, there's still another strata to go. There's still many more strata to go, I think, for people.
I thought that was revolutionary, actually, what he did, because as soon as you see that the film is based around an African-American family, I think everybody assumes it's about race. And actually, that's because the default setting in kind of a everyman story is that that is a white family going off on vacation. As you say, they're middle class, they're clearly happy. And I thought to make it not about race and to make it a kind of broader statement on society. For me, it's exactly what you're saying, Chris, which is it's the toxicity of the American dream, really. Mm. The American dream we've been sold for decades, which tells you, you know, it's not about where you're from. It's about what you can become and what you can achieve and what you can own ultimately. And what the film exposes is that privilege and coincidence and luck and getting a leg up and all of these things actually are massively what ultimately kind of feeds into whether you're a success or not. And I think all of those observational films with the other family, I just thought those bits were really, really amazing because it really revealed that it's about the American dream and about mm-hmm. capitalism as much as it is about race or isolation within society or anything like that. And we just have to say, I have to say, Elizabeth Moss in this film is, she plays privileged white bitch very well, enjoying her third glass of rosé on the beach. Her shadow self is phenomenal. Like, there's a moment, there's one shot where she tries to scream. I think that's what she was trying to do anyway, and she can't, and no sound comes out, and she kind of morphs into this screaming, laughing psychopath. I mean, it's just remarkable from her, I think.
Yeah, tremendous. But I also love Tim Heidecker as Josh, but mainly his doppelganger, who is some sort of horrendous, demonic dude bro, douchebag.
Totally, that robe.
When he reaches out to the dying kitty and then does the fake right. out hand through the hair thing, that you can only imagine he's learned from the real Josh, who's an absolute twat. And then later on when he's pursuing Gabe down the jetty and he's all like, doing the, this is a podcast, you can't see what I'm doing, but you remember the move, you see what he does. And he's doing these kind of weird douchebaggy hand movements and gestures and that clearly he's learned from Heidecker's Josh. Really, really great piece of acting.
Well, because it's still him, as you said earlier, right? It's they're both parts of essentially the same soul and the same person.
Yeah.
Like, and it's that thing of you can't really escape yourself, the worst bits of yourself and the kind of other bits of yourself. And that kind of setup shows it more than anything when you're like, oh no, that's him. That's really him. It's just the like really dickish part of him. Mm. And that's what we've all got inside all of us.
Yeah, I really thought all of the performances like across the board were just amazing because it takes such amount of skill to have that distinction. And there's a real clear delineation between the two, the humans and the untethered. I thought Winston Duke was fantastic. You know, the way that he plays this sort of big, lumbering, embarrassing dad. and then he sort of uses his physicality for like comedy, but also for like power and just to create this sort of horror with his tethered. He has this sort of really like sort of dead-eyed look, which is, in a different way becomes really frightening.
I interviewed him for the regular podcast, so go and check that out, interview out if you haven't already. And he's a fascinating guy, you know. It's really, really, really thoughtful actor. Mm. It's a great performance. He didn't just do the Jean-Claude Van Damme slick your hair back thing, which he could have done easily and maybe got away with it, but you know, he's more about the inner life of these characters.
Yeah.
But I didn't ask him this question, and I kind of wanted to, but I felt by the end, as he was getting really thoughtful about this character, I thought it would be really facetious. But Abraham seems so much bigger than Gabe. And I wanted to know how he did that. Like how, because it's obviously body language and posture and the way he sets himself up, but he seems hulking in a way that Gabe doesn't with his close to middle-aged American dad who's maybe had a bit of an easier life than most. And so he's relaxed into this kind of looseness. His posture's not what it used to be.
Yeah.
That was really, really interesting physical delineation. And, you know, Christ, the Adelaide and Red performances, my God. But also the smile, Umbre smile. Shahadi Wright Joseph plays both Sora and Umbre. Her evil smile is terrifying. Terrifying. I want to give a shout out to an article in The Hollywood Reporter by Richard Newby, who's an African-American film writer, and he has a really interesting take on it. He talks about there's a whole section of the article which is about white affluence and the idea of double consciousness, and he quotes the writer W.E.B. Du Bois' collection of essays, The Souls of Black Folks from 1903, and so there is something in there as well. It is not overtly about race in the way that Get Out was, but there is certainly something there. So check that out. It's on thehollywoodreporter.com if you want to check out that article. Very good stuff indeed.
And just on that, I did think it was interesting that Adelaide spends most of the movie in chains. I mean, that can't have been an accidental use of imagery, like that, given the sort of violent history of America, that's you know, that they had to have a black person in chains is, you know, that's really significant. And I think that's something that perhaps Jordan Peele was thinking about when writing the film.
Okay, we're going to take some questions now from listeners, and you've sent into my DMs. Thank you for that, and thank you for once again not sending me any dick pics. First question that I've seen comes from @LifeInFantasia Anahit Beyrouz, who asks, although I loved a lot of the movie, its critique about privilege and the marginalisation of large groups of the population seemed to me to be undermined by how the tethered were depicted as monsters. It felt almost like a demonisation of the oppressed. I understand Peele's point was that they were made to be that way, and obviously Adelaide and Red switch places. So there is some nuance, but nevertheless, the tethered spend pretty much all the film being the violent antagonists of a horror film. We'd be interested to hear if that struck any of you. I mean, we talked about this a little bit. Mm.
I think, as you say, they are living within a world that they have been forced to exist in, and it becomes about survival, ultimately. I didn't necessarily see them as violent aggressors as much as people trying to reclaim or claim a life that is fit for a human being. And I thought the contrast, you needed that contrast to be stark to understand the difference between the tethered and the humans, quote unquote, above the surface. And I think that otherness that Peele kind of sketches out is really kind of indicative of what's going on in the world at the moment, which is you have entire underclasses of people, both in this country and in America and probably lots of other countries, who are fighting for survival. Look at the poverty rates in this country. I think it's a really real depiction of the kind of starkness of some of the of the realities we find ourselves in. And actually, I think it makes you question, as an audience member, if you presume them to be kind of base or primal or violent. I think a lot of that, if you watch the film again, is based on your own kind of assumptions,
because it's a horror film and you expect the other to be terrifying,
and they can't speak, and the fact that they can't speak English, that she's the only one that can, and that they make animalistic noises, those kind of things are kind of our assumptions about what a human being is and how a human being functions. So I think it makes you ask difficult questions of yourself, probably.
It is playing on audience expectations, and I would say that by the end of the film, by the sort of twist in the third act, I think they sort of cease to be antagonists. I think that's the point, is that they start as antagonists, and then it becomes far more muddied by the end of it. I can see what you're saying, but I think that's what genre and allegory is used for. You know, they have to be a bit scary because that's the sort of format that we're in. But ultimately, I don't think he's saying that all poor people are violent. You know,
but it is interesting that they make such a bold statement that will reverberate around the globe, and we don't know the scale of this thing, but that's assume that it's just localized to America. It's still a hell of a bold statement, but the statement starts out as a violent one and then becomes one that is essentially peaceful. I don't know what will happen eventually when they break the Hands Across America thing. Will they try and wipe out whatever humans are left? Will there be a war? Will humans declare war on the tethered?
Yeah, and it's very open-ended, right? Like, at the end I was like, but what is the point of them all doing the Hands Across America? What are they getting at with this human chain? And isn't the point that, you know, there's now an Uziverse, which isn't a word, where presumably Jordan Peele's going to explore this in another film. But as John says, I think the waters are so muddied by the end that there's no goodbye, good guy, bad guy, or goodbye, bad guy.
Well, yeah, because well, absolutely.
There is no good guy, bad guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Gabe, I'd say, was pretty good, but otherwise, yeah, you've got Adelaide, the person we've been rooting for at the beginning of the movie, is revealed to be the whole reason for this thing kicking off in the first place. And at the end of the movie, you're clearly, well, I think you're meant to feel a lot of sympathy for Red, who meets that fate down there, ignominious fate down in the bunker.
But even Jason, when Jason, what's Jason's shadow called again?
Pluto.
And when he gets, when he walks backwards into the fire, and you sense that Adelaide feels real grief in that moment, and I think you as the audience do as well.
@DavidO'Storm asked, the compassion Adelaide had for Red's children, did she recognise them as her tethered children?
Well, I think she's, you know, that maternal sense, and it's the scene I just talked about where he walks backwards into the fire and you see the grief on her face. And I think that's the point, is both of them are capable of maternal feelings. Both her and the shadow are both capable of compassion, of love, and it isn't just a simple thing that she's the bad one, therefore can't feel any empathy, or she's the good one and they're the bad kids. I think that kind of muddling of morality, and it comes back to basically all the human stuff we share, which is empathy, compassion, grief. Those things seem to be universal with the tethered and the non-tethered.
Indeed, Lee Beedley.
Yep.
that's the level we're getting to at this point, guys, because we're about to be being kicked out. I'm just saying indeedly beedly to things. I'm looking through the questions, and I think we've pretty much answered, just in our natural discussion, we've pretty much answered everyone's questions anyway. So that's good. There is one I wanted to get to very, very quickly from Christelle B, from Brewery _ Chris, who asks, was it the case that the tethered could only kill their above-ground doppelgangers? And I'm saying no to this. But if you look, for example, when they attack Kitty and Josh and their two daughters, each counterpart kills the other, so to speak. But there's that guy who shouts at Umbre for standing on his car. She kills him. And it's fairly clear that when the bit where they're trying to rescue Adelaide from Kitty's doppelganger, that the two twins are out to kill Jason and Sora.
Me
anyway.
Because you do wonder why Kitty kind of threatens Adelaide with a knife but doesn't kill her at that point.
Yeah.
But then, the twins go hell for leather for everybody, so it seems all bets are off at that point.
Yeah, my feeling ultimately is that everybody is fair game with the exception of Adelaide, who is Red's and Red's alone.
Oh, yeah.
So do not kill her. And, she looks like our leader. So don't kill the one who looks like our leader, basically. On that note, that is a good note on which to end this Us Spoiler Special. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you enjoyed the Jordan Peele interview as well. Our next Spoiler Special, perhaps less to get our teeth into, but fun nonetheless, it is going to be Shazam. Shazam, with the director David F. Sandberg and producer Peter Safran. So that's going to be a lot of fun as well. That'll be out sometime in the next 2 weeks. Until then, we are out every Friday as well with the regular Empire podcast. If you don't already listen to it and you don't already subscribe, we would love it if you did. But until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Terry White.
Goodbye.
It is goodbye from John Nugent.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off down Santa Cruz Boardwalk to play whack-a-mole. Thanks for listening. See you later. Bye.